I'm no tech genius, but I knew if I wanted my business to crush it, I'd need a website now. Thankfully, Bluehost made it easy. I customized, optimized, and monetized everything exactly how I wanted with AI. In minutes, my site was set up. I couldn't believe it. The search engine tools even helped me get more site visitors. Whatever your passion is, you can set it up with Bluehost. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, what have you got to lose? Head to Bluehost.com to start now.
Brenton Roussel is a gastroenterologist with University Gastroenterology. He's joined me on the line. Doctor, how are you, sir?
Matt, nice to meet you, and thanks for the invitation to join today. I really appreciate the opportunity.
I really appreciate you doing it because it's very, very, very important. So let's talk about this. First of all, we should start off with the age recommendations. Can you tell me what happened that made it? I mean, do we start getting more and more people like in their teens and 20s? They're starting to get diagnosed with colorectal cancer, so they drop the age because of an average or something. What happened there?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Matt. And I appreciate you highlighting the new guidelines that came out a few years ago through the American Cancer Society, that 45 is the new age for average risk individuals, where 50 was the previous age. And I'll talk a little bit more about what average risk means. Mm-hmm. But this goes back to some new statistics. You know, back in 1995, the American Cancer Society tells us about 11% of new colon cancer diagnoses were below the age of 54. And you fast forward to 2019, so this is before we made the guideline change, 20% of new diagnoses were below the age of 54. And, wow. You know, it's kind of startling. If you look at the mortality rates from colorectal cancer, for all ages above 50, it goes down over the last several decades. And then it's starting to creep up, actually, over the last couple of decades for individuals 45 to 49. So it really highlights the issue that you brought up. And, you know, there's certainly a big thing that we talk about with our patients that, you know, if you're having symptoms, you're concerned, it's never too little to talk to your primary care provider, to a gastroenterologist.
Let me ask you, when somebody's thinking about this, by the way, I put the text line up for people, 438-9776. If you want to text in and ask doctor a question, I'll relay the question. We'll get the answer because in case people might have specific issues that maybe they could benefit everybody. But, what are the symptoms? Like if they, you know, you don't want to have symptoms, obviously, because that means it's probably progressed at least decently anyway. Or let me ask you, is that the case? And if you do have symptoms, what are people looking for?
That's a great question. So the majority of diagnoses come in patients who don't have symptoms, and that's why we impart a screening protocol. Mm-hmm. But for patients who are experiencing blood in their stool, black tarry stools, or having unexplained weight loss, an abrupt change in their bowel habits, you know, certainly that would raise alarm to talk to a provider about those symptoms. And then, you know, I alluded to it before about this concept of average versus not average risk. So for someone to be average risk, they can't have a history of polyps personally, mm-hmm. family history of colon cancer, family history of colon polyps, or another type of disease that increases the risk of colon cancer, like inflammatory bowel disease. And so there's a good contingent of the population that should actually get screened well before 45. And that depends on the individual, their personalized risk factors. And again, it just really begs for a discussion with the healthcare provider, and the primary care provider is a really, really good place to start with that.
This is really interesting because this is one thing I always wonder, like, do you have a family history of something? Well, define family. Like, I know my great grandparents might have had an issue, or my cousin might have an issue. When you ask that kind of question, who am I concerned about as a patient? Is it my immediate parents and siblings, or is it who am I looking at?
Yeah, sure, Matt. So I think the easiest one to remember is first-degree relatives, siblings, parents, and children, of course, too. Once you start to have multiple second-degree relatives, cousins, grandparents with colon cancer or colon polyps, that would also put you into a risk category that would be considered high. And so the guidelines really get into different details that I think it warrants a discussion with a provider, but generally we worry about first and second degree relatives.
First and second degree relatives. And so if you have somebody who has in that, is it one person, multiple people? If I had a mother who was, or grandmother who had impacted by colon cancer, that would put me at a higher risk level?
Yeah, it would. So we would start you at 40, assuming that, you know, your grandmother was diagnosed later in life. You would then, and this gets into the nuances of the guidelines,
sure.
But then would enter into kind of a regular routine scheduled colonoscopy based on an average risk schedule. If you have a first degree relative with colon cancer diagnosed before the age of 60, then you're going to be considered high risk throughout your life, and you're going to undergo a more intensive screening program. And often you're going to start 10 years before the diagnosis of that first degree relative. So for example, if you were diagnosed with colon cancer at 55, your children would need to start doing screening at 40. If you were diagnosed at 45, they would need to start screening at 35. Wow. So there are a lot of different details that play into when you should start. But again, talking about it is important. It doesn't mean you can start early, right? These conversations we should be having with our friends, family, we should, you know, abandon any taboo about talking about this screening because it's effective and, you know, it saves lives. The data supports that.
Michael Rosenbaum and his Smallville co-stars take you behind the scenes of one of the greatest shows of all time.
Talkville.
I just had a flashback.
Tom Welling's here.
We're going to do a podcast.
Throughout the year, we've got a lot of season ahead of us.
It's Big Talk.
This is good fan stuff.
Yeah, like, there was some good stuff.
If you're watching the show, this is good stuff.
Yeah. On Smallville. They made it like this is the first time they've seen the guy ball.
That's hard.
I thought it was pretty dark.
It's Talkville.
We're pumped.
The Smallville Rewatch Podcast.
You got to be a part of it.
Follow and listen on your favorite platform.
We talked to Dr. Britton Russell from University Gastroenterology. It's Colon Cancer Awareness Month. Maybe some of you out there have been putting it off. You've been saying, "Yeah, I don't want to do it." It doesn't sound like the most pleasant of things. Although everybody I know that has had one, has said it's actually, you know, for all intents and purposes, I hate to say pleasant experience, but it's not a bad experience by any stretch. Some people have actually told me it's the best sleep they've ever had. And had no side effect, nothing. So it's all been, you know, relatively positive. Is that generally the experience for most people?
Yeah, I'd say after the procedure, pretty universally, patients, you know, are surprised how quick it was. They probably aren't going to remember the procedure and are excited to have the rest of the day off from work, too,
right,
which is really nice. and resume eating, whatever they want. But, you know, getting into it, there are two points of stigma I think that I often address with patients that I counsel on colon cancer screening. The first is being the bowel prep. You know, there unfortunately is no way around needing to clean the colon.
Yep.
The benchmark for us as gastroenterologists doing these screenings, we need to find polyps that are less than 5 millimeters, and that's less, it's smaller than a pencil eraser.
Wow.
And so we're really doing a detailed exam, getting these out before they turn into an issue many years down the road. And, you know, there are new products on the market that taste better, that work better. Some are liquid. There's a pill form that's out right now. And so, again, have a discussion with the provider. We want to make sure that you do this in the most comfortable way possible. But also, you know, we have to acknowledge that this is a sensitive exam. It is invasive. I really believe our staff at our endoscopy centers at University GI, we do an awesome job making people feel respected, safe, well cared for. And it's a quick experience. I mean, the actual procedure itself generally lasts less than 15 minutes. And then again, you're waking up in recovery, you're thinking about where you're going for brunch that morning, and you're carrying on with your day with a peace of mind knowing that you got a good exam.
Is there one of the things that we talk about too, and I think we should probably explore this a little bit with people, is you talk about prevention. Like one of the cool things I didn't know until, you know, speaking to people from University GI is that, you know, the colonoscopy is both the test and the treatment at the same time, correct? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, you have the concept of detection and prevention. So, you know, the FDA has approved different screening modalities that are stool-based. And more recently, there's a blood test that has not really hit the market in a broad sense. But detection would be like Cologuard. It's a very example, you know, very common right. example, or FIT testing, where you submit a stool sample. You're looking either for pieces of abnormal DNA or trace amounts of blood in the stool. And that, if that's positive, would trigger a colonoscopy to investigate further.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing a colonoscopy, you are doing the detection, and you're also intervening in these polyps before they have years to grow into a colon cancer. And so that's where the prevention part comes in. You're literally preventing cancer by intervening before it goes through the multiple stages of becoming a cancer. And so that's why colonoscopy remains the gold standard for colon cancer screening and the gold standard for diagnosis after you have an abnormal stool study. I would say for those of you in the audience or, you know, listening today that are considering colon cancer screening, may not be up to date, both modalities are fine, you know, stool-based testing or colonoscopy. But I would say go with the one you're comfortable with. Something is better than nothing, although I would still consider colonoscopy the gold standard.
I got chastised from my sister because my doctor said, you know, you're 45, you should do this, and said, he told me to do the Cologuard thing, so I did that. And she's like, why did you do that? You wasted your time. I said, why? She goes, because if it comes back abnormal, you're going to have to go get a colonoscopy anyway, so you might as well just skip to the end and do the colonoscopy. That way you know for sure, and then it's all the prevention stuff's already done. You wasted. I was like, I don't know. So every time I hear about the other option, I think of my sister who's in my head who yelled at me and said, go to the end game. That way you're there for sure, and if there's anything there, you don't have to do it again. You have to do something else again.
Yeah, that's a sister that really loves you, Matt. That's hold on to her.
I got the only one. That's it. The other siblings couldn't care. Couldn't care. Yeah.
I think, again, getting back to any modality that someone's comfortable doing and accepting that if you do have an abnormal stool-based testing, it does trigger a colonoscopy necessarily. Mm. You know, if you look at Rhode Island does pretty well with being up to date on colon cancer screening. Mm. As a state, across all populations, it's around 69%. And if you look at other states that aren't doing as well, Wyoming, California are down into the 50s. That's great relative to those states, that's fine, but we're still not capturing 31% of the population, right? So on average, United States, about 40% of eligible adults have not undergone colon cancer screening. And so if we do the numbers, right, we have 40% of tens of millions of individuals in the country who aren't getting the opportunity to either prevent cancer or at least to detect it at an early stage so we can cure you of that cancer. And so I feel like as a community in primary care, gastroenterology, as brothers and sisters to each other, mm-hmm. you know, we really need to encourage getting the screening done because it's effective. And we're leaving a lot of people out there that could otherwise, you know, benefit from this and perhaps have their life saved.
Hi, I'm Joe Salcihi, host of the Stacking Benjamin Show.
You want financial independence, don't you? You want to know how all this stuff works instead of these little sound bites?
Listen to some finance people on the radio, and they're like, oh, you're stupid.
Because people fall in this trap all the time.
You don't deserve to have money.
You're buying a lot of air.
Interest sucks.
Oh, the horrors.
You never knew personal finance could be this fun.
Subconsciously, I now feel rich.
Oh, geez, like, I'm out of here. Revolution over. We won.
Yeah. Deuces, everybody.
Stacking Benjamins. Follow and listen on your favorite platform.
Now, from the most obvious benefit is what you just said, having your life saved, preventing things from happening and all that. Is there, I know that usually if you get a clean screening, there's a decent amount of time before you have to do it again. It's actually pretty generous, right, in terms of you don't have to do it every year. It's not one of those things that, yeah. unless you have a certain circumstance. But if you come back, you get your first colonoscopy and you're healthy, how long is it going to be between you when you recommend get another one?
Sure. Yeah. So if you're an average risk individual that has not had a history of adenomatous, we call adenomatous or precancerous polyps, then it's 10 years between colonoscopies. Wow. If you're somebody with a family history, depending on the age that individual is diagnosed, it goes down to every 5 years. And then there are some nuances with other patient populations. But yeah, you know, for the average individual, you're looking at 3 or 4 colonoscopies over your entire lifetime in order to be compliant. And that's why, you know, people come in for their first colonoscopy and I congratulate them. I literally do. I say, congrats on advocating for your health and starting a journey to make sure you stay healthy. We want to make sure this is a good experience for you because you're going to do this another 3 to 4 times at least. And so for most individuals, you're absolutely right. It's a big break between the procedures. Again, it's a day off from work. It's time to advocate for yourself. And we want to do a good job, so we really want you to come back.
How easy is it for you guys, university gastroenterology? I know people will hear this, and they're like, I want to make an appointment. Do they have to go through their primary care? Can they call you and just make an appointment just to come in?
Yeah, so most insurance plans require a referral through primary care, but you're more than welcome to give our office a call, and we can help get that information. University GI, we have four locations in the state, and so, you know, being a Rhode Islander and acknowledging that my fellow Rhode Islanders don't love driving more than 20 minutes, that's okay. We have a location close to you, you know, and go further on both sides of the Washington Bridge. So we really try to make it easy. And so talk to your primary care provider. You may have a discussion about stool-based testing, or if you're interested in colonoscopy, just have them send a referral over. Most screening colonoscopies do not require an office visit. It's a direct book. So you get the referral, you come see us on the day of the procedure, get the procedure done, we give you a clean bill of health, and then if not, you know, we set you up with the next specialist and surround you with a team to take care of whatever finding we have.
If somebody, God forbid, finds out they do have something, a polyp there, and the polyp is cancerous, and I mean, this is one of the more treatable cancers, correct? And this is something that's not necessarily, it might not be pleasant, but it's not necessarily something that is dire.
Yeah, you're right. So it's not only treatable, but this, if found early, is curable. And that's a big word in the oncology community, is curable. That's really what we're going for. And so still, you know, because of delays in patients uptaking colon cancer screening, about 60% of colon cancer is diagnosed at an advanced stage. And once it's metastatic, you are no longer in a curable phase. And even when it's advanced and the tumor is larger and perhaps involving more of the colon wall, you require chemotherapy after that. If caught early, the majority of early colon cancer is actually treated with surgery alone. Oh, wow. And again, the goal is for cure. And so that's why we want to catch this early and You know, we always talk to our patients in recovery. So we have the procedure done. Often the patient's waking up and the family member goes there. And in the cases where I've diagnosed colon cancer, we have a discussion there. Everybody's sitting together. We go into detail. We answer questions. And we're fortunate to live in a state with a plethora of specialists. I work with some wonderful colon cancer surgeons, or colorectal surgeons, and oncologists as well that we team up with and immediately surround you with experts. So again, we want to intervene early, but if, God forbid, you have this conversation with your gastroenterologist, be rest assured that it immediately triggers the next step in getting you the care that you need and, you know, to move forward.
I always ask this question, and I only got a minute left, so I'm going to put you on the spot. What is causing this earlier explosion here? What's going on? Do we know?
We don't know. Yeah. We don't know. And I did a lit search last night to really, you know, try to find anything that was new and up to date. It's probably a combination of many things, you know, environmental modifiable risk factors. So trends in tobacco use, alcohol use, obesity, probably some of the non-modifiable things like one's own genetics.
Yep.
There are certainly things in the environment and variables that we haven't identified yet that are contributing to this. So there's a lot of, you know, very robust research going into that question specifically. But today, I don't have that answer. Maybe in the future, I will for you, Matt.
I hope so. Dr. Brenton Roussel, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Best of luck to you. And thanks for giving us all this this great information, a great resource for people.
Thank you for the opportunity, Matt. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
There you go, ladies and gents. Go get your colonoscopy, please.
No Contest Wrestling. O'Shea Jackson Jr. and TJ Jefferson with the biggest names in the game.
Ladies and gentlemen, X-Pac.
Getting suspended in school, that's the number one thing people, when they meet me, they tell me.
There's detention.
Yeah, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, Liv Morgan.
I couldn't believe that was my time. I was so grateful.
Talking about living dreams, no pun intended, TJ. Relax.
I rarely do these anymore, but I was really looking forward to this.
The No Contest Wrestling Podcast. Part of the Rich Eisen Podcast Network. Follow and listen on your favorite platform.